Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Susan Franson. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Ursula, and all you listeners. Well, we have a weather report, so listen to the bad news. Tonight, rain likely and possibly a thunderstorm, mainly after 4 a.m. Mostly cloudy with low around 41. Windy, south wind 16 to 24, gusts as high as 32. Chance of precipitation is 70%. And Thursday, showers and possibly a thunderstorm. High near 49. Chance of precipitation 80%. Thursday night, rain, possibly mixed with snow, mainly before 7 a.m., low around 28. Chance of precipitation 80%. Little or no snow accumulation expected.
So there's that S word again.
Yes.
But the good news is that all of this precipitation is what my grandmother used to call transition weather. It really is a sign that the season is changing. So there's good things to come.
Good things to come. So.
Well, later in the program, we're going to be visiting with Kim Hanna from the Campus Town Association, Action Association, telling us about the amazing changes that are taking place in Campus Town, especially along Lincoln Way across from Lake Laverne. But for the first part of our program, we will be talking about the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, particularly because they have given of the Louise Noun Award, which is a an award that the ACLU gives out, and it's been given to Dan Johnston, Des Moines, Iowa.
I was able to record an interview with Dan Johnston in his Des Moines law office a few days ago. Before we listen to what he had to say, I'd like to answer the question that Ursula asked me when we first started working on this program. Why did he win the award now? He answered the question by briefly describing his most famous case, the Tinker case, in which he defended the free speech rights of students, specifically the right to wear black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. Dan was the ACLU lawyer who successfully argued the case to the Supreme Court in 1968.
And Susan, I remember that case, and I remember the black armbands because this was my generation during the beginning of the Vietnam War. And so before we hear from Dan, I thought it would be fun to speak with somebody who actually wore a black armband at that time and was one of the people that they were arguing about in the Supreme Court. And so I remembered that my older sister, Lucia, was one of the first people at Ames High School who decided to wear a black armband. And so called her up. And do we have my sister on the phone? You there, Lutz?
Yeah.
Oh, there she is. Okay. We're speaking to my sister, Lucia Wright, who's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, Lutz, you were one of the people that wore a black armband in the 60s. Can you describe, first of all, how you made your armband?
Yes. As I recall, I made it myself. It was just a black piece of fabric that I found at home and cut into a length and pinned onto my sleeve on the outside of my clothes.
And then you wore this to school, right?
That's right.
And yes. Why did you do this?
Well, I was interested in the activities of the local SDS movement, and I had friends in it, and we had decided, or they had decided, to do this as a silent form of protest and free expression, freedom of speech to speak against the Vietnam War.
And what was the SDS?
Student for a Democratic Society. It was a leftist group with anti-Vietnam War activities. I was not in the leadership of it, but that was my understanding of it at the time.
And what was your reception when you wore the black armband to school?
Well, we violated some form of dress code. I'm not sure exactly what it was. There was a general dress code for girls that they shouldn't wear pants. So there was some notion of what was appropriate for school, and they felt that it was not appropriate for us to wear black armbands. I think that it seemed provocative, and somehow it triggered people's sense of what was appropriate for a high school child at that time to wear, you know.
And it made you stick out. I think one of the cases, one of the arguments against it was that it was a distraction from schoolwork. And so how did...
Yes, because it provoked, you know, protest and political discussion that was not really part of the conventional school culture. There was, it was a very nonconformist form of self-expression in addition to being a political statement. There was a lot of pressure to fit in with what was considered appropriate for high school, and that was mostly team sports and debate clubs and theater clubs and pep rallies. All of those were considered, you know, appropriate activities, but protesting the Vietnam War was not an appropriate activity.
And do you remember how the pressure was expressed to you? Did fellow students make remarks? Did teachers make remarks? Or do you remember what kind of...
I remember mostly, well, there was some student reaction, and there was also some administrative. I don't remember the teachers, per se.
But they would say things to you, or they told you you couldn't do it?
Yeah, they would shout things at you as you walked down the hallway, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah. You somehow felt that it was worth it to you to express yourself?
Yes, I was quite passionate about the politics involved, and I also felt strongly about my right to wear what I wanted to school. I expressed that in other ways besides wearing armbands, you know, choosing my clothes that were a little bit unconventional sometimes. So, I felt that it was important to... It was a form of free speech.
Okay, but you don't actually were never literally forbidden from doing it here in Ames, right?
You know, I don't recall whether we were stopped. I don't recall being stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like being sent home or told to take it off. Perhaps we were. I don't recall that.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my sons also wore black armbands, and one was in middle school and one was actually in grade school. And I don't remember anything about the middle school. The grade school boy was taken into the principal's office, which was a familiar place for him anyway. and the principal said, you don't know what that means. And he said, no. He said, it means that I'm against the Vietnam War. And the principal said, well, you know what it means? You can wear it. So they were pretty enlightened in the grade school.
Well, you know, I think it. I think, and you know, and kind of an unspoken part of this is that partly this was an issue relevant for the young because the young fight wars, and so as a high school student, you were approaching the age where, you know, not you at that time, but your classmates who were male would end up actually being directly affected, and so. This was really an issue for the young, this war, in a way that I think might not be so easy to remember as to how much all the young people felt that this was an issue directed at them, really, this war.
Yes.
Well, yes. We you know, we had some connection to college-age students, and we certainly thought ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had friends that disappeared after high school. And never came back. So, yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Any last words, like looking back, are you glad you did it?
Oh, yeah. It stands out in my mind as you know, courageous thing to do and interesting and important, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And probably a sense of self that you got from it, really. And, you know, your ability.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for taking a moment in your life in Pittsburgh to just give us a little bit of a flashback to the actual...
Thank you for the occasion to reflect on that again.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
So, to get back to the question, why didn't Dan Johnston win an award in 1978 or 79 after he successfully argued this case before the Supreme Court?
Well, let's first hear from Dan about this case and then follow the story.
Okay. Well, I'll start with asking you to
Tell us a little about the ACLU of Iowa. I'm not sure that all of our listeners are familiar with it.
Well, there's, of course, a National American Civil Liberties Union, and it's comprised of state-based affiliates. And what we used to call the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, but is now called the ACLU of Iowa, is the Iowa affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union. For a long time, two of the mainstays of it were Mr. and Mrs. Allen. He was a mathematics professor up there at Iowa State University. Ed Allen was his name. And they used to come to all the meetings, and they were mainstays of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union.
How long has it been going?
Since 1935.
That's a long time. But so what's the Louise Noun Award?
Well, Louise Noun was the chair of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union in the 80s and 90s, I guess. She was a member of the Rosenfeld family from Oskaloosa, Iowa, who were the founders and the owners of Yonkers department stores. But she was an art collector and a civil libertarian. She was one of the people who organized the vote in Des Moines to change Des Moines to the council manager form of government. But then she became the chair of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union and was its leader for a number of years. So this award is given every year in her memory.
Why is it special for you?
Louise and I were very close. She was the chair of the Civil Liberties Union just as I was getting out of law school. And we worked together and became very, very fast and good friends.
That friendship led to your first famous case.
She was the chair of the Civil Liberties Union of Iowa when some students in Des Moines were suspended from school for wearing black armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War. And the lawyer who had been representing them was a Drake law professor, and it got very controversial, and so he thought that he had to withdraw, and so he did. So Louise suggested that I take his place, and so I did, and eventually ended up arguing the case before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1968.
So what did it feel like to be arguing a case before the Supreme Court when you were just shortly out of law school?
By the time you get to the Supreme Court, you have argued the case so much, you know so much about it, that you feel fairly confident, even though it's a little frustrating because the justices of the Supreme Court use the court to argue with their fellow justices about the case. And so both Justice White and Justice Black were using their questions to really make points about what they believed about the case. Justice White was making the point that even though I was arguing that the wearing of the armbands was not disruptive, it was the purpose of the armband wearing to have students think about the war instead of thinking about their studies. And Justice Black was just arguing that this was an attempt to have the students take over the running of the school instead of the school administrators.
Has this case had any further implications? Many Supreme Court cases are quoted over and over again.
Well, this one is as well, and I think it's probably had a greater effect on education than it has on the law, because I frequently hear about students who wear various kinds of political buttons and things like that to school, and the teachers try to get them to take them off, and so they get a copy of the decision on the Internet and take it to school and show their teachers that they have a right to wear these political symbols.
After the Supreme Court, what came next?
Well, shortly after that, there was a case in Iowa where some labor unions and the Democratic Party and Louise Noun sued the legislature for malapportioning the state legislature. We'd had a new census, and the Republicans who controlled the legislature had drawn legislative lines that were not of the same size in terms of population in order to get political advantage. So two other lawyers, Harry Smith from Sioux City and Bob Fulton, who'd been the lieutenant governor from Waterloo, and I took that case in the Iowa Supreme Court, and we won that case in the Iowa Supreme Court. And as a result of that, a fairly good system now for reapportioning the Iowa legislature was set up and still exists to this day.
Well, I know that eventually in 1977 you became Polk County attorney. Why don't we jump ahead to that?
Okay, well, I was living in Washington and working for the National Center for State Courts when Ray Fenton, who'd been the county attorney, was appointed a district court judge. So at that point, the Board of Supervisors appoints his replacement to fill out his term. And one of my clients, when I'd been a lawyer here in Des Moines, had been the United Auto Workers. And so they asked the Board of Supervisors, with whom they were very close, to appoint me to be the county attorney for the rest of Mr. Fenton's term. And they did that. And then I ran for re-election the next election and was re-elected twice after that, I guess.
Well, when you became county attorney, did you do anything special? Did you just go away along the way it had been done before?
Well, we set up some special programs. I set up a special program for the investigation of incest cases. I set up a special program to mediate with neighborhood residents, disputes between neighbors. And so there were some programs like that that I set up in addition to just prosecuting cases. Des Moines had a very good detective unit, but they were good at finding out who did a homicide, for instance. But sometimes we would have difficulty proving that because they weren't collecting physical evidence from the crime scene to tie somebody to the crime scene. Most frequently, they had someone who would come in and say, so-and-so did this murder, but that person's credibility was sometimes suspect. And so we didn't have any fingerprints or hair samples or footprints. And so when Billy Wallace, who was a very excellent chief of detectives and then became the police chief, but when he resigned, I suggested to the city manager that the new police chief be someone who would emphasize the development of criminalistics, of collecting evidence at crime scenes. And so he appointed a man who had been the head of that in the Kansas City police department. And he became a very good police chief and was police chief for quite a while.
What do you think are the ideal qualifications for a county attorney?
Well, I think a county attorney needs to be concerned about the rights of people as well as just concerned about prosecuting guilty people. I also think he needs to be concerned about how harmful it is to put somebody in prison. And a lot of times that's necessary, but I think he needs to try to find ways to avoid putting people in prison if it's not absolutely necessary. It costs a lot of money to keep people in prison, and it's also very damaging to a person's development as a law-abiding citizen to have him have to spend time in prison. You need to empathize with both the victims of the crimes that have occurred as well as with the defendants and their families as they go to prison and are otherwise prosecuted.
Did you like being county attorney?
I did. It was a good job. I enjoyed it.
So I understand you moved in 1980.
I did. After 8 years, I was asked to go to New York and set up a national group of prosecutors to work for sentencing reform to try to reduce the unnecessary use of prison. And so I did that after I was county attorney for 8 years.
Were there any reasons that you decided to leave if you'd like?
Well, part of it was, I think, being gay. It was, I felt that I was sort of always on the verge of being criticized by people on the religious right for that when I was in office here in Polk County. And so I think it was kind of a relief to get to New York for a while where that wasn't a problem.
So why did you come back?
I came back because I got sick and I got poor. And it's cheaper to live here, and I came back a couple times to visit, and I found that the gay community in Des Moines had really gotten a lot better, a lot more sophisticated, and I felt a lot more comfortable with it. I still had my house here up in Chautauqua Park in Des Moines, and I liked that house a lot. So, and I met some people here I liked a lot, so I just, a number of reasons I came back. Mostly it was financial and health reasons. My health is now restored. But I'm still having a hard time restoring my financial status. My first trip back was I came back for the oral argument in the Iowa Supreme Court for the gay marriage case, Varnum versus O'Brien. I also met a young man there who was just out of law school, who I now practice law with, Joseph Glazebrook, who I really enjoy practicing law with. He's a really excellent lawyer. He reminds me a lot of Norman Jesse, who was the man who was my lover here for a number of years, who was in the legislature and then worked for the county government for a long time and was a good civil liberties union lawyer as well. But Norman died in 2000 of lung cancer.
When I was talking to Veronica Fowler about your award, that she said, yes, it's Dan's victory lap.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I thought the article that was in the Des Moines Register Sunday before last about the award and about the relationship between Norman and me was kind of a pre-mortem obituary.
Do you want to talk about the current case you're working on?
The Rhodes case. Well, you know, that's a case that I have a friend, Sean Strube, who's originally from Iowa City, but who now lives in New York and has been a leader in HIV stuff and the rights of people with HIV and things like that for a long time. He's recently just written a book called Body Count about his experiences both as a person with AIDS and as a person working for the rights of people with AIDS. And he called me up and asked me if I would try to, when I still was in New York, and asked me if I would try to find a lawyer in Iowa for Nick Rhodes. And so I had met Joseph Glazebrook by then, so I referred him to Joseph Glazebrook, and so Joseph Glazebrook was representing Mr. Rhodes. And then when I moved back to Des Moines, I joined in with Mr. Glazebrook in representing Mr. Rhodes in that case.
So you may still be involved in a landmark case.
Right.
Well, I wish you victory, and it's been wonderful to talk to you today.
All right. Thank you. Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we have Veronica Fowler with us by the phone. Hi, Veronica.
Hi there. How are you?
Oh, so glad that you could be with us. As you know, you were just mentioned by Dan Johnston. And so,
yes,
would you like to answer the question that Ursula first asked? Why did you wait so long to give this award to Dan Johnston?
Well, I think it's long overdue. We caught probably, first of all, Dan was such a sort of legal child prodigy. He won the Tinker case just a few years out of law school. And the Noun Award is for lifetime achievement. So I guess poor Dan had to live a lifetime to get the award. I hope, as he was joking, this is not a precursor to an obit. I'm glad his health is restored. But he has put in many, many years of advocating ceaselessly for civil liberties, and it was just about time. So I'm glad we can honor him now.
Veronica, could you give us some information about what the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa does as an organization?
Yeah, well, it was founded in back in the 30s, back when there was a lot of Red Scare going on, and the government, in the name of fighting, you know, communism and socialism, started really cutting away at civil liberties. In Iowa, we were one of the earliest chapters formed by Edward S. Allen and Ames. Math professor. Really what we use as our guiding light is the Bill of Rights, and we have been particularly active in First Amendment issues, but certainly we do all sorts of things with criminal justice reform, in which Dan has been so active, in due process, in gender equality, racial equality, equality, you know, despite your sexual preference, a wide, wide variety of issues. Sometimes I'm very jealous of other advocacy organizations that have just one issue because they can really focus in on that. And civil liberties encompasses a lot of different basic freedoms.
Well, thank you. And we certainly here at KHY appreciate your First Amendment support because KHOI really is the embodiment of a First Amendment ideal. So,
it absolutely is. And I love it. I live in here in Ames, and I love it as my homegrown radio station.
That's great. Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us. Susan, you, Amy?
Well, I was just going to ask you to say just a little bit more about the three-legged stool, the three aspects.
Oh. about the ACLU. And we joke that we are a three-legged stool. And one of the legs, the key pillar of what we do, is litigation. We file lawsuits, such as the Tinker case. The other part of the stool is legislative work. We work with legislators, encourage and help them often to draft bills that protect and expand civil liberties. And then we also try to educate and persuade legislators to not vote and not support bills that impinge on some of our basic rights and civil liberties. And then the other part of the three-legged stool is education and outreach, which, of course, what I'm doing right here, right now. I'm the communications director. It's what I do every day. Just informing people about issues. We're a nonprofit organization, so we can't tell people how to vote, but we certainly have a perspective, which is to enable people to exercise their civil liberties. And so we put out a lot of a newsletter, emails, and urge people to contact their legislators to support a certain bill or to ask them to not vote for a certain bill.
Participatory citizenship. Participatory citizenship.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Veronica. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Okay. Take care. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg with my co-host here, Susan Franson, and we were talking about the award that was given to Mr. Dan Johnston from Des Moines. It's the Louise Noun Award for Civil Liberties, and that was Veronica Fowler talking about what the Civil Liberties Union is. And we have another guest here who's joined us. Kim Hanna is here from the Campus Town Action Association, and we're going to shift gears and talk about Campus Town.
Well, there's a lot going on there. I can see just from driving down the street that there are big changes, and looks like there are going to be more. So we'd like you to tell us about them.
Absolutely. We have three main projects going on right now, one of which is the 2412 to 2430 Lincoln Way project, which is known throughout town as the Kingland Systems Building. Those buildings were owned by the Champlin family, and they were sold to Kingland about a year and a half ago now. It was December of 2012. And fencing is up. They're getting ready to do interior demolition, and then the buildings will come down after Visha, and then another project just east of that in the 2300 block of Lincoln Way is what is going to be the 2320 Lincoln project, which is a Gilbain Development Company project, which currently is where the First National Bank building and Lori's Coffee, that building, are located.
So we're really talking about the two easternmost blocks along Lincoln Way of Campustown.
Well, they're the two east of Welch. Campustown actually goes all the way to Ash Avenue, so they're kind of two in the middle of Campustown. But it definitely starts right where the University Memorial Union and Lake Laverne are. Once you enter into Campustown in that area, those are the two blocks where a lot of construction will be going on over the next couple of years.
So things are really going to look dramatically different by the time this is all done.
Can you describe what
it'll look like?
We have design requirements in place through the city zoning ordinance that require brick. So it's actually going to look probably closer to what it might have looked like 50 years ago before the First National Bank building went up. It's brick facades. The 2320 property is retail on the first floor, and then 320 beds, so about six stories of student housing. And then the Kingland project is three stories, and that's retail on the first floor. Kingland's offices will be on the second floor, and then Iowa State will have offices on the third floor.
So the block between Lynn and Stanton,
mm-hmm.
right now is an area that has space between the buildings.
Right, and it won't anymore. It'll be much, it's very broken up right now because we have a building and then a parking lot and then a parking lot and then a building and then an alleyway drive through and then St. John's by the campus church, and that's obviously not going anywhere. So it will be brick and retail and a lot of movement and transparency, and throughout that whole block, it will be beautiful.
But the campus bookstore building will remain.
I can't talk about that project yet. It's not public, but there will be changes on that corner as well.
Can you give us a time frame? The project that we're now seeing happening is Kingland. The fence is up on Welch Avenue,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Ames Tribune had a picture the varsity sign coming down.
Yes, the Ames Historical Society took the varsity sign, so that piece of Ames history isn't going anywhere. The Ames Historical Society has possession of that now. And I know that Kingland worked with several businesses to recycle the tin ceilings that were inside a couple of those buildings, too, which is very cool. Fencing is up along Welch Avenue. It will be going up along Lincoln Way. Probably by the end of this week, they had to do some utility work to move the street lamps that were there, because those have to be moved for the construction of that site. Fencing is also up around the Gilbain project, which is the 2320 Lincoln project. And if you have driven eastbound on Lincoln Way, you can already see the sidewalk has been pumped out into the parking lane of Lincoln Way there. So hopefully we'll be able to keep both lanes open throughout the project. The sidewalk is in the parking area, but there are cement balustrades up, so you are safe when you walk along those projects.
So it'll be possible to walk through the area.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And we still have businesses that are open and operating in the middle of all the construction. Jeff's Pizza is not going anywhere, and they're open, and they're excited to make sure that everyone knows that they're open and they're not affected by the construction. The Singer Station, which is just west of Jeff's Pizza, is also open throughout construction. And then First National Bank actually relocated temporarily into the 119 Stanton building. That's the Legacy Tower building. And so they are there as well. So they are still in Campustown.
And Lori's Coffee?
And Lori's Coffee moved. They're moving into the Mother's Pub building, which is on West, but is technically also still in Campustown, which is exciting. They're still in Campustown. I believe they had hoped to be open this coming Monday. They're still getting everything ready, so I think it's possibly the first Monday in April is when they hope to be open in their new home.
So what you're saying is during the day, you can go to the building where Mother's Pub is.
And it's Lori's Coffee.
And And at night, it'll still be Mother's?
It'll still be Mother's Pub. So it's a really great partnership that they were able to reach to keep Lori's open during the construction phase.
That's great.
It is.
You say during the construction phase. Mm-hmm. Are there plans for Lori's to move back?
There are potentially. We're trying to keep all of our businesses to remain in Campus Town through the transitions. And so you'll have to stay updated on our website to find out where everyone is moving and coming back to.
Well, one of the things that surprised me when I went down to try to find the relocated buildings, mm-hmm. Businesses, and I found Charlie Yokes,
yes.
Just half a block away,
yes.
From where,
yep.
It was.
They are. They moved to the 2500 block of Lincoln Way. So they're very close to their former home, which was, if you've been in Ames long enough, it was the People's Bar, which had great live music in the 80s and 90s. And then before that, it was People's Pharmacy. So they were able to move just down the street, and they still have a great Lincoln Way location.
And another addition to Campus Town is the Indian restaurant?
Yes. Indian Delight Express. So they still have their location in West Ames by the West Ames Hy-Vee, and then they've opened a second location in Campus Town on, I think their address is 120 Welch Avenue. So they're in the 100 block of Welch.
And there's some restaurants that may be around a little longer than this immediate period, but there's the Rice House.
Mm-hmm.
You said that's mm-hmm. Korean. Is that right?
We have two Korean restaurants in Campus Town, Scallion and Rice House. And so Rice House is very close to where the new Charlie Oaks is.
And I noticed Project 2020 is an Asian restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? We used to have a Malaysian restaurant. We used to have Indonesian.
Project 2020 was in the property that is now Kingland, and they were able to relocate just up Welch Avenue into the former Golden Walk space, and so they do different Asian food options there.
Kim, what is your goal as an organization, as an advocacy organization for Campus Town? How are you approaching the future of Campus Town? What's important to you?
You know, we're a membership-based organization, and we're really here to help make Campus Town an even better place than it already is. This renaissance, this rebirth of Campus Town is very exciting. There are a lot of things in process, not just this redevelopment. We are comprised of a board of business owners, Iowa State, and city entities and community members. And one of the things that we're very excited to roll out this summer is a facade grant program. With the new construction, we also want to make sure that what stays in Campus Town also gets a little bit of an updo, a shine, if you will. And so we've been working with the city to create a facade grant program that's similar to what Main Street has. It's will be administered by the city. The funding comes from the city, but it's a way to maintain the uniqueness and the character of Campus Town in some of the buildings that aren't going anywhere. And that's a lot of our buildings. Mm-hmm. I know it looks like everything is coming down in Campus Town, but we're a 9-block business district. Mm-hmm. And right now the construction is very concentrated into a couple of areas, but we want to make sure that everybody gets a fresh coat of paint, a nice new look as we bring Campus Town up to the 21st century.
One of the biggest issues in Ames is housing.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about housing in Campus
mm-hmm.
Town.
You know, we have several projects that include student housing, including the Gilbane project, and then Randall Corporation is doing a construction site on Chamberlain right next to Little Taipei, which is a delicious restaurant in Campus Town as well. And I think it's very important to, as we move forward in Campus Town, it's moving into a 24-hour district. And so having students live there makes sense. They're right across the street from campus. The logistics of getting them to campus is a lot easier when all they have to do is cross Lincoln Way. It's easier for Cyride. There was a lot of new development on the west side of Ames for student housing, and that's been very difficult for Cyride to accommodate getting that many students into campus. And so it's great. We think it's great to have them in Campus Town. It makes Campus Town more vibrant. And it also encourages new services that have been missing for a while. I mean, Campus Town, when I was little in the 80s, had a lot of different options that aren't there anymore. And so we're really working on getting those back.
It's great, but there's the issue of affordability.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to mm-hmm. make sure that housing is affordable?
The housing is market, and we can't do a lot with that, but we're really working to make sure that the retail spaces stay affordable to some of our businesses so that they can relocate back into Campus Town if they want to, or if other businesses and Ames want to come into Campus Town, it's more affordable. And so that's something that the board is really working hard on, what we can do to help keep unique small business in Campus Town, while we also encourage some regional and national chains that fill in those missing services that we need as well.
So you're saying nothing is really being done to keep housing affordable in the new projects that are, or the new buildings that are going up?
That is out of our realm of expertise. So we're focusing on the businesses.
But you do have a lot of locally owned businesses there, especially restaurants, and a lot of diversity.
And we do.
That's very precious.
Yes, we are very proud of the fact that we are the most, we have the most concentrated ethnic restaurant mix in town, and it's delicious. We have food from all over, and it's something, a lot of it is also available by delivery, so anyone in Ames can get, they can get their Thai kitchen or their Mr. Burrito or their Fighting Burrito or their Pizza Pit, so and Jess Pizza as well.
Okay, well, Susan, you actually spoke with one of the businesses that were that left Campus Town.
Yes, I did, and had a lot of fun with that. And I should say, and play the sound clip, that when I walked in to Random Goods, which has relocated to Main Street, that I was greeted by retro music. And so that will precede the interview because that's what was playing.
Okay, so should we listen to that before we finish talking about Campus Town? Okay.
It's a pretty good crowd for a Saturday, and the manager gives me a smile, 'cause he knows that it's me they've been coming to see, to forget about life.
I'm at Random Goods, and this is a new store for downtown. We're doing a program on the stores that left the old Kingland block and are now in new spaces.
My name's Renee Rule, and I'm the manager of Random Goods.
And how long have you been downtown?
We have been here since January 7th was the first day we opened, so not too long.
So was it a difficult move?
Yes, it was very cold when we moved, and it's the second time we've actually moved in the last six or so months, so it was quite a hassle.
So where did you move from the last time you had to move?
Well, originally we were in the old Varsity Theater in Campus Town, and then we moved down next to Charlie Yoke's, and that was in June. So we started out there, moved in June, and then moved again in January.
So why did you decide to move downtown?
Well, we looked around in campus, but the spaces were just so small for the kinds of things we had, and it just wouldn't have worked. So we started looking down here because the spaces were a little bit bigger, and then we found this spot and really liked it.
So you haven't quite had long enough time, I guess, to find out how your customer base is going to be, or have you?
Well, since the winter was just so yucky and it was so cold, we didn't have very many people in, but it's starting to pick up now, and we've noticed there's a lot more community members.
So could you describe your store?
Yeah, we've got quite a bit of funky things. We specialize in vintage clothing and costuming. We really like to find things from the decades, 60s, 70s, and 80s for costuming. We also have some houseware stuff, and then some regular style clothing. We don't have quite as much of that. And then lots of costume accessories.
So do you have a lot of people calling for costumes or coming in for costumes?
Definitely. Throughout the year, it's very busy during the Halloween season, but all the time we have people calling for certain costumes.
What do they look for when they come in for costumes?
I've heard quite a few different requests. The lady that just called was looking for a Benjamin Franklin costume. I had somebody ask for a banana costume, but we get a lot of things like Renaissance fairs and bus parties on campus, like Hawaiian cowboy, that kind of thing. It's kind of all over the board, really.
I see a lot of hats. Are the hats a big seller?
It depends. I've noticed that now that we're down here, we do sell a lot more hats, people who actually wear them, some of the community members. But we sell a lot of fedoras. Those are pretty popular. We had a gangster party recently at the high school, so we sold a lot of fedoras and gangster hats, but cowboy hats sell too. It just kind of depends on who comes in and what they're looking for at the time.
This isn't a consignment shop, is it?
Yes, it is.
And what are your terms on consignment? Do you have special days for people to bring things in?
We don't have any set times. We do ask that if you're bringing 50 items or more, that you give us a heads up that you're coming. But people bring things in kind of whenever. And it's a 40-60 cut. We take 60, unless it's a higher-priced item. So if it's $30 or more, then it's 50-50, because we want consigners to be able to get a little more for expensive items.
So what is the most expensive item that you've ever had? Or,
well, we had a vintage Oscar de la Renta dress that was absolutely beautiful. And we saw one that sold online for upwards of $1,500. And we, I think, sold it between $600 and $700. So that was probably the most expensive we've had come through here.
Well, how did the customer find it? I mean, most people who come to consignment shops are expecting not to spend very much money.
Right. Well, we did kind of cheat. We have an extension of our shop, and we have an Etsy shop. So we sold it online, not actually in this location, but through our online store.
Well, you're telling about something that I think is a very interesting marketing phenomenon right now. I've been told from other shops on Main Street that they do significant business online. Do you, besides when you sell an Oscar de la Renta dress, do you often sell things online?
Yeah, we're starting to do it a little bit more now. We didn't quite as much in our old locations, but we are a newer shop. It's only our third year in business, so we're starting to get used to it. But we are starting to put more and more items online just so that we can get a little bit more for our consigners out of them.
So where are your other stores that help you distribute things?
Well, we use Etsy, and then we also use eBay. Etsy is an online, it's a huge database of just handmade and vintage items. It has to be handmade or vintage. It's the only way you can sell it on, so it is a little different from eBay. You just can't sell anything, but just pages and pages and pages of vintage and handmade items.
So do you ever have customers who come in and request something that you look up for them?
Yeah, we do actually have a new program that lets us have a wish list. So if people come in and they can't find something they like in the shop or that they're looking for, we jot it down in our computer and then we actually search for it. We go out and shop, send out emails to our consigners asking if anybody has it. So that is one way that we try to find things for people. It's our wish list.
Did you go into this business because you enjoyed vintage clothing and vintage stores?
Personally, I've always been a big fan of Salvation Armies and thrift shopping and digging in vintage and antique shops, so this is kind of right up my alley.
I have noticed that as downtown has grown and developed, that there are more and more consignment shops. You know, they're for children, and they're, of course, great stuff. And do you find that is an advantage for you or a disadvantage?
I definitely think it's an advantage. As soon as we moved down here, you know, there's a lot more consignment shops in this area, and that's actually really helped our business. Is we can say, oh, go check out the Loft, and the Loft sends people to us, and it's kind of a nice little community of consignment shops. So I think it's really been helpful.
That's really nice to know. So hope you do very well here. And
this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Today we have been speaking with Kim Hanna, who is from the Campus Town Action Association, and she's been talking about the changes in Campus Town. Kim, thank you for coming by today, and anything else you would like to tell us about Campus Town before you head out?
Thank you. Yes, I'd love to. I would encourage everyone to check out our redevelopment page on our website often. We update it as we get information from our property developers. It's a one-stop shop for you to come and check out everything that's going on in Campus Town, and it's our way to have all that information in one place and to keep as much factual information out in the public as humanly possible. So please check that out. It's www.amescampustown.com/redevelopment. And then please come and shop in Campus Town during this construction. I know sometimes people get nervous when they see big construction sites and trucks and everything, but we have 85 businesses and churches and entities in Campus Town, and they need your love over the next 18 months as we go through this big construction phase in our district. So please support our Campus Town businesses. That we're full of hardworking business owners that are in day in and day out to make Campus Town a much better place. And then also we have a lot of events that we do in the summers. Summertime in Campus Town is our summer event series, and we have three big events this summer. Summerfest, which will be Saturday, June 14th. Our Campus Town Cinema event, which is an outdoor movie experience in Campus Town, partnering with Cyclone Cinema out of the Memorial Union, and that will be July 11th. That's a Friday night. And then our third annual Friday afternoon in Campus Town, our big FAC to kick off the fall Iowa State football season, which is Friday, August 29th. And because it is the Ames sesquicentennial, Campus Town is also host to one of the Ames 150 major events, which is Dinky Day. We're celebrating the relationship between Ames and Iowa State and the history of the Dinky and the present of Ames and the future of Ames with all the construction happening, and that will be Friday, September 26th, and that will be those are our four big events this summer and fall, I guess.
And the Dinky is?
The Dinky is that beautiful little trolley that used to travel from Main Street Ames to Iowa State University before there was all of the residential neighborhood in place that you see, those beautiful houses that you see now. It used to be, I believe, just open field or farmland, and so there was a train that took people from downtown Ames to the center of Iowa State University.
And the outdoor movie theater, mm-hmm. outdoor movie theater, where is that
going to
be?
We're going to have that in the 200 block of Welch, which is the same place we have all of our events, and we're still working out on how to make it as comfortable as possible for everyone. As many people know, we don't have a lot of green space in Campus Town. It's something that we're working on, how to incorporate more green space into Campus Town. But we're working on having a family-friendly movie, events around the family-friendly movie, and then we encourage people to bring their lawn chairs and
what's
blankets.
The screen?
We are getting a screen from Cyclone Cinema. They're partnering with us on this, so they provide all the equipment and a screen.
And where will the screen be placed?
It will be in the parking lot between Pizza Pit and the Dogtown University building. Sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Wow, yeah. I had no idea. I better start reading your website.
That's right, amescampustown.com. And you can also follow us on our social media outlets, Facebook and Twitter. Our Facebook is Campus Town Action Association, and our Twitter is Ames Campus Town.
Okay, thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
And come again and keep us updated on Campus Town.
I will.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we have been speaking with Kim Hanna from the Campus Town Action Association. We heard an interview with Dan Johnston and Veronica Fowler from the ACLU Iowa. And we also heard from Renee Rule, a local business person. And we also had a very brief chat with my sister, Lucia, in Pittsburgh about being a teenager wearing a black armband.
And doesn't she get a name?
Lucia Rudenberg-Wright. And thank you, Lucia, for joining us. And we've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Susan Franson. And Local Talk is being engineered by Richard Morrison.
Music you heard included Piano Man by Billy Joel from his CD Piano Man. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find the archive for all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you will find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you've enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And please consider becoming one of the 500 families that donate $20 per month or $250 a year to help us meet our operating expenses. Although we appreciate whatever you can donate that fits into your budget. We also do really want to hear your feedback, either by phone at 292-2878, 292-2878, or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.